Ho, 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 and welcome back to the Corbett Report, ladies and gentlemen. I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you, as always, from the sunny climes of Western Japan, here in mid-December of 2024. And I'm here today with another edition of Questions for Corbett, where you send in the question and I provide the answer. But today I'm going to provide more than that. I'm going to provide a Christmas present for an interested listener. What on earth am I talking about? Well, today we're going to take our cue for the titular question from a comment that came in on the December open thread. For those not in the know, of course, Corbett Report members are, of course, always invited to come in and participate in the open thread, leaving comments, questions, eggnog recipes, whatever you like. And today's question comes in that December open thread via The Throne, who writes, "Jimmy, grant me a Christmas present. A video going into detail the clandestine operations behind the 1993 WTC bombing. I know there is much to learn about what happened there and how that led to the 2001 events, but I'm completely in the dark." Well, congratulations, The Throne, you came to the right place. Because I am not only going to fulfill your request for a deep dive into the WTC 1993 plot, who was behind it, what was it about, how did it transpire, and what came of it. I'm going to one-up you, and I'm going to give you a 5.5-hour documentary documenting the complete arc of Alcy Aida from its birth all the way up through 1993 WTC, 9/11, the war in Iraq, the war in Syria, etc., right up to the doorstep of the present day. All for free! Congratulations. Here you go. Merry Christmas. Of course, for people who don't know, I am referring to False Flags, The Secret History of Al-Qaeda, which is my 5.5-hour documentary doing the deep, deep, deep dive, probably the deepest, most meticulous dive I have ever done in the history of the Corbett Report. And it is 100% available for your browsing, reading, viewing pleasure at CorbettReport.com/Al-Qaeda, all one word. And if you go there, you can get the entire documentary. But since this is just Questions for Corbett and you were asking specifically about WTC 1993, we're going to watch a clip from that False Flags documentary dealing specifically with the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, that plot, how it came about, who was behind it, and what transpired. So if you want to know, well, here is your answer. Merry Christmas. But I will invite you to stick around, make sure you go through the whole thing, because on the other side, I will come back and I will tell you a little story about how this particular subject relates to an interesting story in, I guess, my origin story, my development as a budding conspiracy realist podcaster. Anyway, stick around through this on the other side for that. But here you go, The Throne. Here is the deep dive that you asked for.
Last winter, the FBI was praised for its speed in cracking the case of the World Trade Center bombing and bringing four suspects to trial. Now, there is some evidence that the FBI may have known of the plot in advance through an informant and might even have stopped the bombing that killed six people.
When Ahmad Salem, a former lieutenant colonel in the Egyptian army who arrived in the United States in 1988, began working as an FBI asset, he was not originally assigned to infiltrate Islamic terror groups. No, in 1988, the Cold War was still on, and the FBI tasked Salem with penetrating KGB and Russian mafia rings operating in New York City. But by 1991, things had changed. With the Cold War over, the Bureau's priorities were shifting. Salem's handler, Nancy Floyd, who appreciated his work, thought the Egyptian informant's background might make him useful to the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. Salem's new handlers in the Bureau's counterterror division, Louis Napoli and John Antisev, put him to work infiltrating the groups raising funds for international Islamic terror on U.S. soil. His first priority, insinuating himself into the ring around the blind sheikh, Omar Abdel Rahman, including El-Sayed Nosair, then on trial for the slaying of Kahane, and his Calverton shooting range associates. Salem was remarkably successful in his assignment. Haunting the trial of Nosair, he soon befriended Nosair's cousin, Ibrahim El-Gabroni. El-Gabroni immediately took to the affable Egyptian, introducing Salem to Nosair in jail and describing him as a new member of the family. In a mere matter of weeks, Salem was caught on camera as one of Rockman's bodyguards, even personally driving the blind sheikh to Detroit to deliver fundraising speeches. Soon thereafter, El Gabroni invited Salem to join him for dinner at his Brooklyn apartment. There, after turning up the television in the dining room, explaining that he feared the apartment was bugged, El Gabroni sought to recruit Salem for a special mission.
I was in Brooklyn with Ibrahim El Gabroni. Ibrahim El Gabroni is Sayed Nasser's cousin. He said that we should start to do something, brother, so the government have some pressure and they don't put brother Sayed in more troubles. So I said, sure, of course, we should do something. He said, okay, do you know how to build a bomb? I said, of course, that's what we do. He said, okay, I want you to build some bombs. And I'll tell you later, what do you need? I need, so I said to Ibrahim El Gabroni, I need explosives, I need detonators, I need people to help me build the bombs, I need a safe place to build the bomb in. He said, okay, let me make some phone calls to Afghanistan.
At this early stage, the plot was less of a precise plan and more of a vague idea, devoid of details. Even the target of the proposed attack was undecided, with Salem being told that the group intended to set off bombs at 12 Jewish locations, including temples, banks, and Jewish centers around Brooklyn and Manhattan. Without knowing it, and with hardly any effort, Salem had been recruited into an operation that would eventually result in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Salem worked the plot as best he could, meeting more of the Calverton shooting range associates and gathering information from the cell members to pass along to the Bureau. As the preparations for the bombing began to take shape, Salem's role in the FBI sting operation seemed clear. He would lead the cell along, swapping out the explosives for a harmless powder before the bombs were placed. Then, when the cell was ready to strike, the FBI would swoop in and round up the plotters. But that is not what happened. Salem's remarkable success in infiltrating an active plot to stage terror attacks in New York, something that most FBI assets fail to accomplish in the course of their career, is, in retrospect, stunning. But not as stunning as the FBI's response to this incredible turn of events. As author and journalist Peter Lance, who interviewed many of the FBI personnel involved in the story, explained in his book Triple Cross, part of Salem's deal with the feds was that he would be a deep cover asset, as opposed to an informant who was willing to tape conversations and swear to his undercover evidence on the stand. Salem, who had family in Egypt, was deeply wary of the blind sheikh's deadly reach. So the Bureau promised him that he'd never have to wear a wire or testify in open court. But in June 1992, Carson Dunbar, a rising young star in the FBI's New York office, was appointed to head the counterterror division. Dunbar and his deputy, John Krauthammel, didn't trust Salem. Soon they were trying to get him to submit to additional polygraphs, and, eventually, they broke their deal with Salem and demanded he wear a wire. Salem refused and withdrew from the operation, shutting the FBI out of the bomb plot.
It was a silly personal confrontation, and actually he said, and I quote him, "You son of a bitch, coming from the Middle East, dragging sand in your shoes all the way up to here to tell me how to run my FBI and how to do my job." I told him, "Sir, I am doing your job. None of your agents could have went undercover that deep. I'm doing it. You're not." And that even provoked him more, and he said, "Get out of here." I walked out of his office. I looked at Nancy and John. I said, "Guys, when this bomb being built by somebody and goes off by somebody else, don't come knock on my door." And that was it, and I walked away.
With Salem out of the picture, the Ali Mohammed-trained, blind sheikh-supported, Al-Kifa-connected cell continued on with their plot. But with internal disputes disrupting their plans, they had to find someone else to actually build the bomb. They found that person in Ramzi Youssef. to this day, despite having been caught, tried, and convicted for the World Trade Center bombing, little is known about Ramzi Youssef's origins or even his identity. The 9/11 Commission, relying on the torture testimony of his uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, identified him merely as a Sunni extremist whose real name was Abdul Basit. But this supposedly devout Muslim fundamentalist is reported to have hung out at karaoke bars and dated B-girls during his trips to the Philippines while his wife and daughters waited for him in Balochistan. Even his birthplace remains a mystery. What is known is that Youssef learned bomb-making in Osama bin Laden's training camps in Afghanistan in the early 1990s, perhaps from Ali Mohammed himself. That in 1995, Newsday reported that the FBI was considering a probe of whether the CIA had any relationship with Youssef. And that in 1999, Swiss journalist Richard Lebeviere reported that a classified FBI file indicates that he was recruited by the local branch of the CIA. And, like so many of the other key operatives in the Al-Qaeda story, Youssef was able to avoid regular screening procedures, waltz across borders with forged travel documents, and enter the United States without a visa. On August 31, 1992, Youssef and Ahmad Ajaj, a fellow Mujahideen who Youssef had allegedly met at the training camps in Afghanistan, flew from Pakistan to the US despite lacking the proper travel documents to do so. A miraculous feat that the FBI has alleged was enabled by direct assistance from senior Pakistani intelligence officials. Upon their arrival at John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York on September 1st, both men were immediately detained by immigration officials. Ajaj, acting loud and belligerent, was caught with a crudely forged Swedish passport and taken to a back office for questioning. The US government was pretty sure Ahmad Mohammed Ajaj was a terrorist from the moment he stepped foot on US soil, the Los Angeles Times later reported, noting that his suitcases were stuffed with fake passports, fake IDs, and a cheat sheet on how to lie to US immigration inspectors. But that wasn't all. Among his possessions, inspectors also found 2 handwritten notebooks filled with bomb recipes, 6 bomb-making guides that included pages from Fort Bragg military manuals, and 4 how-to videotapes concerning weaponry and surveillance training. A judge was charged with passport violations and sentenced to 6 months in prison. Youssef, meanwhile, tried a different approach. Dressed in traditional peasant garb and carrying an Iraqi passport without a US visa, Youssef strode confidently up to the immigration inspector and declared himself to be a refugee seeking asylum from the oppressive Iraqi government, politely asking to be admitted into America. After being questioned and fingerprinted, one alert immigration official noted his links to Ajaj and sought to detain him, but there was not enough room in the INS lockup, so he was released on the condition that he show up at an asylum hearing later. Youssef then left the airport, took a cab to New York's East Village, and immediately met with Mahmoud Abu Halima, the Red, who had trained with Ali Mohammed and who had served as the getaway driver for Nosair before being waved away by the hotel doorman. Youssef set about professionalizing the ragtag band of misfits, transforming their vague Jewish locations plot into an altogether more ambitious plan. To plant a bomb in the basement of one of the twin towers of the World Trade Center, collapsing it into the other tower and killing tens of thousands in the process. He got to work immediately, organizing the cell, renting a storage locker across the Hudson River in Jersey City, and beginning the 5-month task of constructing the bomb. Without Salem, the FBI ostensibly no longer had an asset in the cell to watch as the plot took shape. But if there had been a serious investigation underway, unraveling the cell and discovering their intentions would have been trivial. Ahmad Ajaj, who had been caught with a raft of terrorist training materials and bomb-making guides, remained in contact with Youssef the whole time, speaking to him frequently via the prison phone. But although those calls were taped, no one from the FBI or any other agency monitored or even attempted to translate those phone calls until after the World Trade Center explosion the following February, and no one traced the pair's flights back to discover that they had both boarded in Pakistan without the proper travel documents and had even sat together for the first leg of their journey to New York. Salem even tried one last time to warn the FBI about the cell. Meeting his old handler, Nancy Floyd, at a Subway sandwich shop near the FBI's New York office in October of 1992 to collect his final $500 cash payment, He informed her that he had heard that the group was planning a new attack and begged her to put surveillance on Abu Halima and Salome. But it was no use. Carson Dunbar had taken her off the terror investigation, and all she could do was pass along the suggestion. Salem's warning was ignored, and no one followed up on the lead. The FBI had followed the Al-Kifah plotters to the shooting range, investigated their role in the Kahane murder, had an informant in their midst reporting on their plans for a spectacular terror attack, and now another high-level terror operative had been allowed to enter the country and proceed with his activities unmolested, just as Ali Mohammed and the blind sheikh before him. And so it was that at noon on February 26, 1993, Ramzi Youssef and Iyad Ismail, a Jordanian associate, drove a yellow Ryder van into the underground parking garage of the World Trade Center, parking on the B2 level. Youssef ignited the 20-foot fuse and fled. 12 minutes later, the bomb went off.
We think a bomb caused this explosion.
The floor seemed to have exploded down and collapsed into the level below that.
The Department of Justice and the FBI are operating on the very educated assumption that this was the work of a terrorist bomber.
And we're also told now that there are 4 people confirmed
we
dead.
We call this the terror of the tower. And from now on, people in there are going to feel even more vulnerable than they've ever felt before.
The bomb, cutting through the parking garage with an explosive force of 150,000 pounds per square inch, might have lacked the explosive force to fulfill Youssef's goal of toppling the towers, but it did wreak havoc. 6 people died, over 1,000 were injured, and 50,000 were forced to evacuate the building in the chaotic aftermath of the explosion. Learning of the bombing, Bruce Hoffman, a terrorism expert working for the RAND Corporation, remarked, "We may be talking about the opening salvo of a new conflict for a new world order." As the investigation into the bombing began, a letter arrived in the offices of various New York newspapers claiming responsibility for the attack. The letter, sent under the name Liberation Army, 5th Battalion, issued 3 demands: end U.S. aid to Israel, end diplomatic relations with Israel, and stop interfering with the internal affairs of Middle Eastern nations. If these demands were not met, the letter promised that 150 suicide soldiers would be ready to commit more attacks, including launching strikes on potential nuclear targets. If there was any doubt about who was behind the explosion, those doubts were quickly dispelled. Just 2 days into the investigation, in one of the FBI's first descents into the pitch-black, smoke-filled 5-story crater left by the blast, an explosives enforcement officer from the ATF found the proverbial needle in the haystack, apart from the Ryder van itself bearing a vehicle identification number. The van rental was traced back to Mohammed Salome, one of Ali Mohammed's trainees from the Al-Kifah Center. Absurdly, Salome was apprehended on March 4th, 1 week after the bombing, when he returned to the Ryder rental office in Jersey City to reclaim the deposit on the van. Salome's arrest quickly led to the arrest and eventual conviction of 3 others in the Al-Kifah cell: Nidal Ayad, Mahmoud Abu Halima, and Ahmad Ajaj. It also led investigators to the apartment of Ramzi Youssef. But it was too late. Ramzi Youssef had boarded a flight to Karachi the night of the bombing and then vanished, flying from country to country with impunity, plotting assassinations and bombings in Pakistan, Thailand, the Philippines, and Iran, and concocting an elaborate plot called Bojinka to blow up a number of airliners in mid-flight before finally being captured in Pakistan in 1995. But it was not just Youssef himself, the mysteriously protected terror mastermind who had entered the U.S. without a visa, who vanished. When Pakistani federal investigators later went to check their immigration records, they discovered that all of the documents pertaining to Youssef's journey to the United States in 1992, including his embarkation card, had mysteriously disappeared. In the wake of the bombing, the FBI, now facing enormous public pressure to round up those involved and bust the terror cell that they had infiltrated and abandoned just the year before, turned once again to Ahmad Salem. Once again, Salem was able to quickly penetrate the blind sheikh cell and to begin working with them on a new scheme, the so-called Landmarks Plot, to bomb key targets around New York City, including the UN headquarters, the Lincoln Tunnel, and the George Washington Bridge. This time, the FBI arrested the plotters before they could stage their attack. But at the trial 2 years later, Salem had a surprise for the prosecution. He had secretly recorded dozens of phone conversations with his FBI handlers. Conversations that revealed for the first time the FBI's real role in the World Trade Center bombing.
FBI agents might have been able to prevent last February's deadly explosion at New York's World Trade Center. They discussed secretly substituting harmless powder for the explosives, but they didn't, according to the FBI's own informant, Imad Salem. Unbeknownst to the FBI at the time, Salem recorded many of his conversations with his handlers.
I'm holding 903 pages of draft transcripts.
William Kunstler represents Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman and several others charged with conspiring to blow up a series of New York City landmarks 4 months after the World Trade Center bombing. That case has not yet gone to trial. Kunstler confirmed newspaper reports of the Salem transcripts. In one, Salem complains to an FBI agent, "Since the bomb went off, I feel terrible. I feel bad. I feel here is people who don't listen." The agent replies, "Hey, I mean, it wasn't like you didn't try and I didn't try. You can't force people to do the right thing."
Predictably, in the wake of the blast, the debate began to center on the government's mismanagement of the case. The blind Sheikh's entry to the U.S. had been a mistake. The NYPD's refusal to investigate Nosayer's accomplices in the killing of Kahane had just been a politically expedient omission. The FBI having pulled their informant out of an active terror plot before it developed into the World Trade Center bombing was simply incompetence. The presence of a CIA-linked Fort Bragg stationed Green Beret in the midst of this radical terror cell was just an example of blowback. And Ramzi Youssef's miraculous ability to enter and leave countries at will without the proper documentation was just the result of bureaucratic bungling and overworked immigration officials. The admissions of error and professions of blowback verged on admissions of guilt. Even the CIA, in an internal investigation into its role in supporting the Al-Kifa Center's operations, concluded that the agency itself was partly culpable for the World Trade Center bombing. But the incompetence narrative soon arrived at its inevitable conclusion. The very agencies that had so signally bungled every step along this path were now to be given more money and bestowed more authority to conduct their counter-terror operations.
"This year, I'll submit to Congress comprehensive legislation to strengthen our hand in combating terrorists, whether they strike at home or abroad. As the cowards who bombed the World Trade Center found out, this country will hunt down terrorists and bring them to justice."
Others proposed a less charitable reading of these events. Ron Kuby, the lawyer who, along with William Kunstler, acted as a defense lawyer for the accused bombers and their accomplices, did not mince words in assigning blame for the World Trade Center bombing plot. "The mastermind of the plot is the government of the United States. It was a phony, government-engineered conspiracy to begin with. It would never have amounted to anything had the government not planned it." Imad Salem himself summarized the story of the World Trade Center bombing in a phone call with his FBI handler, John Antisev, that was later released to the public.
"I don't think it was, if that's what you think, guys, fine. But I don't think that, because we was start already building the bomb, which is went off in the World Trade Center. It was built by supervision from the Bureau and the GA. And we was all informed about it, and we know that the bomb start to be built. By who? By your confidential informant. What a wonderful, great case." "Well." And then he put his head in the sand and said, "Oh, no, that's not true. He is son of a bitch." "Okay, well, it's built with a different way in another place, and that's it."
If this pattern of missed opportunities and miraculous cross-border movements really had been the result of mere incompetence or inattentiveness, then the resources and attention that were thrown at the problem of international terrorism in the wake of the World Trade Center bombing would have improved the intelligence agency's record against their erstwhile foes. But, remarkably, the scarcely believable trend of the early 1990s, that of intelligence agencies consistently missing the terrorists operating directly under their nose, border agents allowing known terrorists to pass from country to country unmolested, and law enforcement officials letting these Al-Qaeda-linked operatives off the hook did not just continue into the late 1990s, the trend actually accelerated. And as Al-Qaeda went from a loose-knit group of a few dozen amateur mujahideen at the beginning of the decade to the premier international terrorist organization at the end of the decade, the number of mistakes and missed opportunities multiplied from the merely unbelievable to the downright impossible. And snip! I'm going to cut it right there. I'm going to be a tease. I mean, you want to know more, right? You want to know where this story is going from there. Heck, you want to know how we got to this point in the story, don't you? You want to know the full story of Al-Qaeda. Well, as I say, boy, have I got a present for you. It is False Flags, The Secret History of Al-Qaeda, the 5.5-hour deep dive documentary. As I say, probably the most meticulously researched piece that I have ever produced on any subject. So I wholeheartedly would like to bring it to the attention of any Corbett reporteers out there who don't know of its existence. And please, it's there in transcript form, in audio form, in video form, all 100% completely for free, as everything I do is, for you to, explore to your heart's content. So, Merry Christmas, The Throne. And on that note, of course, Merry Christmas. Well, if you want to give the Merry Christmas present to somebody in your life, well, actually, it is now officially too late to guarantee that anything that you order from the New World Next Week store will get there in time for Christmas. In fact, I'm going to guarantee it won't get there in time for Christmas by this point, but still, 'tis the season to go shopping. So if you want to shop and put the receipt under the tree for whoever you buy it for, you can go to newworldnextweek.com and purchase The False Flags, The Secret History of Al-Qaeda 3-disc DVD set, the full 5.5-hour documentary on DVD, available at New World Next Week. And as you know by now, of course, the Christmas holiday code is in effect. So for anyone out there, you just type in Christmas25, all one word, in the coupon code area of newworldnextweek.com when you're checking out, and you will get a 25% discount on any Corbett Report DVD or USB that you purchase, including False Flags, The Secret History of Al-Qaeda. Or, if you are a Corbett Report paid member, then you will be able to log into the site, look at this past weekend's newsletter, and at the very bottom there will be the code that you can use for 50% off. So it would be a crime not to avail yourself of that savings, and I hope you will do so and help get this word out to more people in a physical format. Having said all of that, as I promised, there is an interesting story about this WTC 1993 plot that relates to a story that I think about from time to time. Because it occurs to me that there are people, when I first started the Corbett Report, when I first started getting into this and podcasting about 9/11 and intelligence agencies and deep state operations and false flag terrorism and things, probably the most common sort of thing that I heard from friends and family and others was, are you sure you want to be doing this? Won't you be on a list or something? And my response was always, well, if there is a list, well, then that's exactly why I am doing this, because I don't want to live in a society where we have to worry about lists and what have you. That's exactly what I am fighting against. So yes, I will go out and do this. But there are moments in the course of any podcaster or public figure who is putting this information out there where you have to commit yourself to that. Am I really going through with this? Am I really prepared to do this? And one such thing happened fairly early on. I believe in 2008, I released a short mini YouTube documentary, a podcastumentary, whatever it was called at that time, or whatever I was calling it, a short 10-minute video about the WTC 1993 plot. And it certainly was not as well-researched or deep-dive material. It had some of the elements of this story, but not all of the ones that you just saw. But it was a good first attempt for a young budding podcaster, and putting that information out there. And when it came time to post that video, I remember thinking, well, the obvious title is WTC 1993 was an FBI job. And so I went to go and post that video, and as I was hovering over the upload button, I remember pausing and really thinking about the fact, I'm putting this out there in the world under my name, I'm not hiding behind any facade or pseudonym or anything. My name will be attached to this, and you better believe, at some point, probably someone from some deep state alphabet soup agency is going to see something like this and go, well, move him up the list. And I had to think about that for a second. Am I really doing this? This is what I'm going to do with my life, right? Yes. And I pushed that upload button. And I remember that moment because it is a moment that occurred to me a few times in the early days. Do I really want to go through this? Am I really committing to this? And every time I said, yes, I'm doing it. Let's do it and upload. And I must admit, I have less and less and less and less hesitancy over the years in doing this because I have committed myself time and time and time again. And it's perhaps like any other muscle that you flex. And the more you do it, the easier it gets. Yes, of course, I'm committing to this. I've done it many, 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 many times in the past. I can do it one more. So that was just an interesting little part of this story from my own personal development and my own personal journey. WTC 1993 was an FBI job, was something that I thought about before I posted, but I posted it anyway. And I would encourage if anyone else out in the crowd, if you are serious about this and you are serious about going to the next level and taking this information out there, well, then don't hide your light under a bushel, shine it for all to see. And who knows what will eventuate. All I can say is that WTC 1993 was an FBI job, was scrubbed from YouTube along with everything else that was on my YouTube channel. So, oh well, it has been preserved actually on BitChute on some other people's channels. They uploaded it from my early YouTube channel, and it should be up on Odyssey in my vast archives now, my thousands of videos on my Odyssey archives. So it should be up there. It should probably be up on Rumble, etc. So you could really find it if you wanted to, but I would suggest you just go to this. This is really the work that I'm proud of, that I think I will stand behind. It is CorbettReport.com/Al-Qaeda. And there you go, the throne. Merry Christmas. Ho, ho, ho. You ask, I deliver. Anyway, we're going to leave it there for now, but thank you again for committing your mind time to this exploration. And I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again in the near future.